194 of the Cricket Her Weekly. Gosh, Sid, there's been a lot of news crammed into the last week. It's like one of those things you wait ages for a bit of news to talk about over the winter, and then a million pieces of news come along at once.
And we're actually recording 3 days early as well.
We are,
Friday, which means that we've watched the first England match, the England-India series, but we haven't watched the one that happened tomorrow or yesterday or 2 days ago, whenever you listen to it.
And then there's another one the day after that.
Okay.
So it depends exactly when you might be listening to this or watching this. But let's talk about what we do know that's already happened, because there's been a bit of a leak this week in the Telegraph about what the future is for women's domestic cricket in England and Wales, I should say, to be technically correct. A little bit of a summary of that piece. Essentially, the regions are going back to being counties. So we've currently got 8 regions, and there will be 8 counties who host the existing teams. And the idea is that they will apply to do that in January. There will be a tender process, and I guess that the ECB will then judge the best 8 applications, and those will be the ones that are successful.
Yeah, as Elvis once said, love me tender.
Oh, Sid.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
So where does that leave us in terms of like change from where we are now, Raf? Particularly for the top players, are they likely to see things change very much, do we think?
No, I think probably from a player perspective, things are going to look very similar. One thing that we should say is that none of this is actually coming in until after the 2024 season.
So yes, everything season will, after next.
Exactly. So everything will look basically the same for the English summer of 2024, and then these changes will come into effect that winter.
And so the competitions will still remain the same as well.
Yeah,
we're still going to have a Charlotte Edwards Cup.
I think that's what we're expecting. Yeah, I don't know that that the Telegraph piece kind of officially committed to that. It said that that was what was likely to happen. So I sense that there's maybe still some things that are a little bit up in the air. But I think from a player perspective, it probably will look fairly similar. Some of the regions very much behave like counties anyway, not mentioning any names. Thunder. So from that perspective, probably it will look very similar. But we did have a particular comment from Mike Turner, who said, this move does not fill me with joy. Does it fill you with joy, Sid?
I'm not sure it fills me with joy quite, but you know, I think it probably is the right move. I think the key issue with the regions in terms of like the future is that the regions have been very successful in the primary thing they were set up to do, which was, you know, to develop the cricket from a cricket perspective. But the next step is to develop the women's game from a commercial perspective so that ultimately the game can stand on its own 2 feet. You know, ultimately we don't want a game that is being subsidised, you know, by men's international cricket. And so in order to try and, you know, achieve that, you know, the regions probably aren't in a position to be able to invest the additional resources they need to turn themselves into sort of operating commercial businesses. And folding the regions back into the key counties is an opportunity to do that. Essentially what it means is that those key counties are going to be expected to invest money, particularly in sort of the marketing side. They'll be investing, you know, their resources, their kind of their own Twitter accounts, their own people that are working in their marketing and branding and sales departments in order to be able to do this. So hopefully it puts the game on a more sustainable path commercially and from a business perspective.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where the positives are, because ultimately that's what we need to take forward, a game that is, you know, not just successful from a cricketing perspective, but successful from a commercial perspective.
Absolutely, yeah. I feel like the ECB actually have kind of set up the regional structure as sort of like eight mini Loughboroughs. And by Loughborough, I mean their kind of elite performance centre.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it, actually.
Yeah, and so actually it's been all about, it's kind of been a first step on the path to professionalisation of the domestic structure, in the sense of actually broadening the number of players who are able to make a living from playing cricket and actually giving them resources to develop as cricketers. But as you say, it hasn't always been smooth in the sense of, you know, there was an incident last season where I was wanting information about something that was happening at Beckenham. It was when the Stars had named Alice Captier as their wicketkeeper, and then she wasn't their wicketkeeper, and I wanted to know what was going on, and I had to ring somebody based at the Oval to get them to give me the information that I needed as a journalist. So it hasn't been smooth in the sense of them not having, the regions not necessarily having much resources beyond actually the ability to have a director of cricket, a full-time head coach, and then your players, and your pool of professional players has gradually expanded. But the other stuff has sort of been nice to have around the edge.
And that's not to say that some people haven't done some incredibly good work, particularly Sunrisers, in terms of, you know, their marketing and their, you know, their outreach and their branding and all that stuff. There's been some great stuff done, but this will allow kind of everyone to take another step forward in terms of that commercial sustainability.
Yeah. And as we understand it, the kind of team names, the team brands, will actually carry over into the new era, or at least some of them. So, for example, we're expecting the Southern Vipers to become the Hampshire Vipers. It may be that Sunrisers, whoever gets that particular franchise, or whoever gets that kind of particular women's team as part of their county, maybe, you know, it might be the Middlesex Sunrisers or the Essex Sunrisers. But it says a lot about the development of those brands that actually there's definitely a good argument for keeping those. So I think, yeah, it's gonna kind of be different, but also look similar. But you know, the key point actually is that you'll be able to have much stronger alignment, and that's the thing that we've been missing really. So for example, the ECB trying to organise double headers between, you know, Sunrisers and Middlesex, and you go, well, are those the same? They're not really the same. And actually, if you can have it as well, it's the Middlesex men and the Middlesex Sunrisers, or the Panthers, aren't they, because it's the pink thing, the Middlesex Panthers and the Middlesex Sunrisers, and it's all Middlesex, then that's much easier. And that's why double headers have worked in the 100. That's one of the key learning points from the 100. It's not double headers are brilliant under all circumstances. It's double headers are brilliant when the people who are running the competition think that the teams are the same and treat the teams the same. And that's what the ECB are trying to get back to by actually saying, here's a great opportunity for the men's counties to have their women's teams as counties.
Yeah, and to build sustainable businesses in the same way that, you know, the men's football teams are doing. You know, look, and the kind of the model is, you know, a football club like Arsenal that are building an increasingly successful and sustainable, you know, women's football business, and that's the key to it. It's about building businesses. So I'm still sitting here. My mind's just been blown by the Pink Panther thing, really, Raph. I've been following cricket for a long time, and the Pink Panther thing,
Really?
Yeah, I'd never...
You didn't know that?
To me, that's why they were the Panthers. Because, so, you know,
okay, anyway.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to think of anything else for the rest of the day now.
So it is really interesting, though, because one of the things that's making me really cross about this is actually the way that Telegraph piece was written and the quotes that were in that Telegraph piece from anonymous county chief execs. Frame this as a totally negative thing for the men's counties. And a lot of the conversation on social media is about this being a negative thing for some of the men's counties, because of course what we're doing effectively is elevating 8 counties to be super counties, because they will be the ones that have professional women's teams attached to them. And I mean, woe is me, Sid, woe is me. You know, the men's counties complaining they don't have enough, they're not going to have enough money to run women's teams, they should be seeing this as an opportunity. They shouldn't be complaining about it. And also, okay, if you don't have enough money to run a professional men's team and a professional women's team, then I'm sorry, but we don't have enough money to sustain things like the Men's County Championship, which is really expensive, very costly. And what revenue does it actually bring in? That's going to be really controversial, I know, with some of our viewers. But if we're looking at it from a kind of monetary perspective, then why do the men's counties insist on persisting with things that are unprofitable? It's okay when it's men's cricket, but as soon as we say, actually, guys, because it is men generally, you should really be thinking about 50% of the population within your counties are women. You should be doing something for those people. As soon as you come along and say that, they get really defensive and they go, oh, it's going to cost us a load of money. Well, so does running the Men's County Championship. So that makes me really frustrated.
Yeah, despite the fact that the ECB basically said they will continue to, you know, fund this stuff at the current levels. What the counties are being asked to invest is resources into things like marketing and, you know, hosting the games and things like that. They're not being asked, you know, directly to, you know, pay players' salaries at this stage, for example.
Until 2029, at least, that's when the ECB has committed these resources. And the thing is, like, you can't have it both ways. There are smaller counties who are going a bit nervous, going, oh, will we get one of these teams? It's really easy, from where I'm sitting, it's really easy to know what you need to do if you want to be one of the 8 successful people who get a tender to host one of these women's regions at the moment. So what do you need to do, Sid? Well, you get on the phone to your director of cricket, your women's director of cricket, at whatever the nearest region is. So let's say you're Somerset and you're concerned, are we going to be the host? You get on the phone to the director of cricket at Western Storm and you say, hi, we're really keen to be the host. What do you want from us? What do you need as a region that you don't have at the moment? Okay, you then write that in your tender.
Yeah, and it's an opportunity for those counties. Do we think that it's a foregone conclusion which counties this will go to? I mean, you know, I think it's to a certain extent. I mean, Yorkshire are clearly going to get the northeast one. Lancashire are going to get the northwest one. Some of the others are a bit more open, are they?
Well, I think, you know, they...
Well, where are Stars going to go?
In theory, they all should be open. So this is why I'm saying that really any county should be able to bid, because it's not just, so, okay, you've rung up the director of cricket and you've got a list of requirements. You then say as well, oh, I want to promise that we will have all of the women's matches will be played on our main ground. That's another thing that you can say that's going to win you the tender. Obviously some of these... We feel that it's a bit of a foregone conclusion. It doesn't necessarily mean it is, but I think that the really interesting one in that respect is the Stars, isn't it? The Stars, who obviously originally, in the KSL days, the Kia Super League days, were the Surrey Stars. They're now Kent and Surrey. Where do they play all their games?
Well, they play almost all their games, or the majority of their games, played at Beckenham, which is obviously owned by Kent.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Surrey did come out, you know, a couple of weeks ago,
actually,
and we dropped a big hint about all this stuff a couple of weeks ago. When we talked about this, Surrey came out and talked about the possibility of building another dedicated ground in which to host their potentially women's games in the future. So that's where that was actually coming from. So.
Anyway,
it's really interesting to see, though, how some of these things are balanced out. There's also issues potentially. Western Storm's the other big one. It's like, you know, which county is going to, you know, put their hand up?
But,
and that's a positive from the ECB's perspective, because they will be able to, you know, they'll be having these counties compete against each other. Say, well, you want it, you have to offer us something.
Yeah. But and also if you're a county and you're worried that this is ultimately a step towards you being pushed down and not being considered in the kind of. At the moment we've got 18 first-class professional counties. Let's say we move away from that. Well, one way to guarantee that you're one of the successful ones is to submit a successful tender for your women's team, because that's the future of cricket. That is the future of cricket, women's cricket. And if you don't have one of these teams, then you've only got
half the future.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but I also think it's quite easy to see how you would be successful, because there are going to be. There are going to be a lot of men at these counties saying, oh, we couldn't possibly commit to that. But it's not hard to see how you write a successful tender. Anyway, let's wait and see how it all unfolds, Sid. It's absolutely fascinating. The other big bit of news that we've had this week is finally we've got the list of England contracts for the 2023-2024 year. I know it's an academic year. You can tell I'm an academic, can't you? But it is. So they run officially, I believe, from 1st of November to 31st of October. So the idea is that after the season ends, then you have like a little bit of leeway, and then basically it's all change. So that's kind of interesting, because you go, well, everyone's had their contract for over a month and nobody's announced it. And we know that the players have basically known about this since August, and nobody's kind of made any step to announcing it. So the first point is, I'm a bit baffled as to why they've just randomly announced them at this particular point in time. But in terms of the actual kind of changes, the key changes to the contracts list, So Maya Boucher and Danny Gibson have been added to the list. Sadly, Freya Davies has lost her England contract. Good news for her this week, Sid. And of course, you'll be very excited about this news because where's Freya Davies going to be playing next summer? She's going to be
playing in Orange next summer.
For the Vipers, yeah.
Yeah, so she'll play when she's available. She's actually, for those that don't know, she's gone back to university to complete her training to be a lawyer.
Yep.
So she's doing that at the moment. That's her key focus for the next year. But hopefully we will see her play some games next year, kind of in between the university work that she obviously wants to get done to go and be a big shot lawyer.
Absolutely brilliant acquisition for the Vipers. Charlotte Edwards just, she knows how to pick them, doesn't she? And this is, yeah, this is fantastic for the Vipers. I do think that Freya Davies has been quite poorly treated by England, I must say. I think it's been a really difficult couple of years for her, and they've really thrown her in and, randomly in the middle of series and given her kind of one game or two games here and there, and not really ever given her a chance to show what she could do if she was a kind of mainstay of the side. Look at the Ashes last summer. She just gets one random T20, doesn't do badly. It was a match that England lost. It was that match at Edgbaston, and then doesn't get picked again. And you just go, well, what did she do wrong? So I think that's, it's been difficult, and hopefully there's a little bit of resolution there in the sense of now being able to kind of accept that, the contract's gone, and doing something else that's exciting for her future. So obviously wish her all the best. But I think it's a sort of a case study of basically how not to manage a player, I think, to be honest, if you're asking me. From a more positive perspective, obviously great to see Boucher, it's not unexpected, and I guess Danny Gibson is an interesting one as well to be added to the contract list. It's interesting that there are also these three development contracts, as they're calling them, that have been issued to Bess Heath. Makes sense, Sid? You happy about that one?
Yep.
And to Lauren Filer and Mahika Gore. Now, the Mahika one is, I guess, she's still at school, she's still young, and they just want to see how she gets on. But the fact that Lauren Filer's got a development contract and Danny Gibson has got a full central contract is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think I told you something about what the selections are likely to be over the next sort of couple of years, and particularly, obviously they're very focused on the T20 World Cup that's coming up. They see Gibson as potentially an important part of that side. I wonder if they're seeing her kind of as the new Georgia Elwes. Georgia Elwes went on a lot of England tours.
Yeah.
She was selected a lot in squads because they feel like, well, she'll fit in. She's if we're down a bowler, we can pick Georgia Elwes.
Yeah.
If we're down a batter, we can pick Georgia Elwes. I wonder if Danny Gibson's probably might have that. I mean, that might mean a tough year for Danny Gibson to a certain extent, because it might mean she gets to, warm a lot of benches. But she's still young and she's got an opportunity to kind of come through that way. And ultimately, Nat Siver will move on because nobody lasts forever, and then that's going to be Danny Gibson's opportunity to step into those shoes.
Exciting for her. Obviously, the worry for somebody like Lauren Filer, who is a few years older than Mahika Gore, and has kind of had this slightly perhaps left field call up to England to only be handed a development contract, and also in terms of the squads that she's in on this India tour, she's not in the T20 squad. She is in the Test squad. Is she about to get pigeonholed as a test specialist? Speak to Kate Cross, that's not a good place to be, because women just don't play enough red ball cricket for that to be something, a situation that you want to be in as a player. So I guess it's an interesting one in terms of where they might see her future. But I guess, there's that middle ground of ODIs as well. As Tammy Beaumont says, we need to fight for the future of ODI cricket.
Yeah, so that's maybe something that viewers might be wondering, Raph, that we've just talked about two stories, and in both cases we've said that we've known about these for months.
Mm.
Why didn't we say anything? Why didn't we spill the beans on this? We dropped a few hints about the county changes, but we didn't spill the beans. Why didn't we do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think there are probably two different reasons for both of those stories. The reason for not kind of blurting out about the contract changes is because I think that's quite personal to the players, and that's quite hurtful news to hear, for example, that you've lost your England contract. So for us to kind of then sort of preempt that and just release that information into the world when a player might not be expecting that, would actually probably add to the hurt of losing that central contract. So I think that that's something you always have to be aware of in journalism, is who's this going to impact if I release this bit of news? You know, we have to be humane about our journalism as well as just being excited to get a scoop. The other point about the sort of Project Darwin or the changes to women's domestic cricket is a little bit more complex, because I guess it doesn't necessarily have that personal aspect. But the thing that we're always dealing with in journalism is that good journalism is about building relationships and about trust. And if people talk to you about things and they explicitly say to you, actually, this is off the record, or I don't want this information to be made public until I choose for it to be made public, then you kind of have to respect that as well. Otherwise, you damage the relationship. You damage the trust. And I think that there are going to be some potentially some quite cross people at the ECB who feel that their trust has been broken, because that leak that Will wrote about in the Telegraph can only have come from somebody who was at that ECB board meeting last week. Somebody quite high up. So they're all going to be looking around at each other going, who was it that leaked that? Who was that? And that is not a good situation to be in. So from our perspective as journalists, Sid, I think we just have to be very mindful of the fact that it's partly about trust and relationships, and it's not just always about who's first to write the story.
Absolutely. Okay.
Okay, so let's talk about the England v India series. Now, as we said at the beginning, we've only seen one T20 so far. It was quite a high scoring one. It was one, if you look at the scorecard, it was won reasonably comfortably by England by 38 runs.
Yeah, well, if anyone wants to know what I made of it, there's an article on the website on crickether.com. I focused on the fact that Heather Knight succeeded in silencing the crowd. She said in the pre-match press conference, I want to silence that crowd at Wankhede. And she did.
They did.
I mean, the poor old TV people trying to find some noise towards the end. They must have been wanting to go and get out their fake noise from when the
during COVID, yeah.
Because it was silenced there. But now, what did you make of the game? What were your key takeaways, Raf?
I was obviously the two standout performances were Nat Sivabrant with the bat and Sophie Eccleston with the ball.
Best two players in the world.
Yeah, well, exactly. And there was a lot of talk afterwards, a lot of people writing, oh, England have silenced their critics, they've overcome the problems that they had against Sri Lanka in September. And I just don't buy that, because what have England done since September? Well, they've nursed Sophie Eccleston back to health after her shoulder injury. And they've also obviously given Nat Sivabrant the time away from the game that she wanted. And she's now back and firing. So all they've effectively done is basically brought their two best players back into the 11. And yeah, now they're going to win games. But does that really suggest that they've solved the issues? Well, it doesn't really, when you're 2 for 2 in the opening over of the game. That's not a great place to be in. And it certainly doesn't suggest that they've solved all of their batting problems. So I don't want to be too negative about it, but I don't think that there's any sort of room for complacency about it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, for me, the slightly niggling at me about it was a game where there was 350 runs scored and it wasn't actually very exciting. And I think that might just should ring a few bells of concern within the ICC and within cricket's kind of hierarchies, because, you know, high scoring games are actually not by definition exciting. Exciting games are close ones.
Yeah.
And just being high scoring doesn't make it exciting, and it certainly wasn't there. But let's see what the rest of the series holds.
That's a really interesting point, Sid. And I know that you've got a point that's sort of related to that, actually, about TV rights, haven't you? Because we did have another bit of news this week. We'll just quickly talk about this at the end, about Amazon have actually bought some of the rights to cricket, haven't they?
Yeah, Amazon have bought the rights to show all of the ICC tournaments, so, you know, the Men's World Cup, the Women's World Cup, T20 World Cup, Champions Trophies, all of that stuff in Australia. And Amazon say this is going to be exclusive. You will have to subscribe to Amazon Prime if you want to watch this stuff. And it's a really interesting move. And I think what's really interesting from a kind of perspective of our game is it shows that the ICC are having to kind of branch out in terms of where they're looking to fund the future of the game. And in some ways, this is what we all wanted, right? What we wanted was more money for the women's game. We wanted the women's players to start to be paid approaching the kinds of sums of money that people are paid in the men's game. That only happens if we sell more TV rights And, you know, if we sell those TV rights for high amounts of money, the people buying them will want exclusivity. So, you know, there were a lot of very upset people on Twitter and social media feeling that, you know, they were going to be locked out of those rights. They didn't want to have to subscribe to something else. You know, and it is going to cost you more money, but kind of this is what we wanted.
Yeah.
That the only place any money is going to come from is expanding TV rights. And this is the result.
That's really interesting. And I guess ultimately that's what where we want the women's domestic game in England and Wales to get to, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, we're going to have to pay for those fixtures as well. It's fixtures that we're currently watching kind of low-quality YouTube streams on. Ultimately, the only way the women's game is going to pay for itself is if someone sells those rights and makes us pay for them in turn. So we're going to wind up paying for them as well. We're going to want at home to subscribe to something in order to do that. Maybe that'll be Amazon in this country as well.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Sid. And thank you for tuning in as ever. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Pink Panther.